Erstmal herzlichen Dank, dass ich hier sein darf. Die Organisierer haben mich gebeten, in Englisch zu sprechen, was ich dann auch gleich tun muss. Aber als Bundesdeutsche muss ich auch mal ganz kurz sagen, herzlichen Dank für die Einladung hier in Wien. Man ist ja immer doch wirklich sehr beeindruckt von dem Engagement hier und all dem, was man noch lernen muss, was in Wien stattfindet an Energie. Und da finde ich das ganz besonders spannend, dass die Spielbreite zwischen Energie und nachhaltiger Entwicklung hier so wirklich intensiv diskutiert wird. Thank you very much for the invitation. The organizers, when inviting me, said they wanted to know 5 things, not just one. And so I'm going to go very dutifully through the 5 things. And I will, in the course of that, also explain why sustainable energy for all as a platform is sort of a UN initiative and not a UN initiative and goes a little bit broader than the UN itself, while being originated, based with, and working under the overall tutelage of the United Nations. They also introduced a little bit of a challenge here for us speakers that they made us talk to a screen that we can't actually see. So if you want to have a little bit of patience with me sort of putting my head around it. What they had asked me to speak about as a topic originally was how energy really relates to poverty reduction or fighting poverty. I would want to expand that idea to the concept of going further faster. And I'll explain in a moment why the dimension of further, i.e. a distance, and the dimension of time, i.e. faster, are so core to that. The 5 points that the organizers asked me to speak about. First of all, the first one was, why should we care? Right here in Austria, why should we really care about what happens to sustainable energy for all, and why for all? Is this now all of a sudden a right for energy? Why does this really matter? Why we should care is really about this. Right? It's darkness. It's the situation under which children get born, complicated surgeries take place, under which teachings happen, under which research happens, under which production should happen, the situation that really limits anybody to work anytime after 5:30 or 6 in many, many countries around the world. So the numbers of people that do not have access to energy or in any meaningful form are really quite stark and startling for that matter. 1.1 billion don't have it right now, and in fact it's, you know, 2/3 or so of the African continent. Even worse are the number of people who do not have access to clean cooking devices. And that may not mean so much, okay, so they don't have access to clean cooking, right? So why does that matter? But it does result quite directly in a choice for many, many women who have every day to choose whether they will want to feed their children or expose their children to harmful exposure to the pollutants that are coming from cooking with the kerosene or cooking with dung, et cetera, et cetera. So these are impossible choices to make, and these are things that motivate us when we're working on sustainable energy for all. But they also are motivated by other things, because whoever doesn't have access to energy doesn't have access to clean water, doesn't have access to education, doesn't have access to most technologies, doesn't have access to markets, etc. Now, poverty has reduced, and we have seen the numbers drop over the last years really dramatically. If somebody 20 or 30 years would have put up that chart and have said, this is how the future will look like, most people would have laughed. This is what's called a hockey stick development. And yet it has happened. And yet, not only has it happened, but also energy has had a lot to do with it. Because with energy, a lot of other things emerge and come that do reduce poverty. This might be, those of you who study economics or study development economics have seen some of that. One can actually find these numbers very beautifully moving in some of these Hans Rosling's things. But you can see very clearly here, for one, is who is on the top right? Right? On the top right are countries like the US or Canada, countries who have the highest or some of the highest GDP per capita, i.e. are the richest amongst the richest countries of the world. And they also have the highest spending of energy per capita. So this is per capita, not by size of the economy. The size of the economy by population you see in terms of the bubble size. So where most people sit, and that goes by the size of the bubbles, on the bottom left. Right? So this is where you have China, this is where you have India, this is where you have the many countries that are moving further up, but even further low, you have the ones that really have very little energy per capita spent. Now, one can say, okay, well, if you're not rich, you can't actually spend much energy. So there's, you can argue about the causality. But what is the fact is that in order to have a high GDP per capita, you do need a certain amount of energy. Now, the question is it really the more the merrier? Does one really, really need to spend more and more in order to have that higher income? First of all, just a quick note. Everything's connected, right? Everybody who works on that odd word called sustainability knows that. That is what explains sustainability or Nachhaltigkeit. So in order to get more better agricultural production, you need better access to water. To have better access to water, you need better forestation, you need better educated people, etc. Now, the reason why sustainable energy for all is a goal, as a sustainable development goal, came through the process of the UN was precisely because it sits quite very much at a nexus of a couple of things that drive a lot of that. Now, we can play a little moment, a little game here that's a little bit like the Adventskalender that are so popular here in Austria, right? So you have to open a number in order to see what's behind it. Anyone knows goal number one? Or goal number two, we now know goal number seven. So if you add those behind that, then you see how when you're trying to see the sustainable development goals from the perspective of energy, how you can see that there is a nexus between food, energy, and water that many of us believe sit very centrally in supporting the poverty goal. Now, of course, you can very much argue that none of that will happen without political stability, or none of that will happen without the gender dimension of work. And that is also very true. So in the end, all of the SDGs sit together. But when you're starting to prioritize, say, infrastructure investments also, this is one way of looking at the goals and how they fit together. Little example from the water world. If you want to have less water spent, you need to invest more in energy, in pumps, in better pumps, in bringing those out there. The same goes for clean water. And the same then ends up with food. So some of those diagrams are being used very much for the analysis needed when trying to figure out when you are in a particular country and you really want to work on the sustainable development goals going forward, how you know, when you twist something on one part of the system, which are the other parts of the system that you also need to work with. But one thing is clear, whether it's clean water or whether it's access to markets or whether it's access to better and faster produced or higher productivity agriculture, it all needs energy. Now, energy gives that and has fueled the economies, not just in the rich countries, but also in the poor countries, but it also brings some very difficult choices. And the choices have to do with the temperature that and the temperature changes that we're all facing. And some of you will know this chart. Some of you will know about the discussions with regard to the increase in world temperatures and about the fact that most of us believe what the scientists tell us, that as of 1.5 of an increase in global temperatures, the overall climate will start tipping. And if we go beyond 2, we'll get into a situation that will be non-sustainable in the medium and long term. And of course, in this last year, we already had 3 months, I believe, where global temperatures were above the 1.5 increase. That is something that on the global average level will be the really dangerous moment. So this is what energy does to us, the way we have experienced it so far, and that is the fossil energy use. The disasters, I think, the climate-made disasters we all know about, and some of the developed countries are now also starting to feel them, whether it is by the difficulties to fish, whether it has to do with the water. I think you are seeing some of that here in Austria in the mountains just as much. Now, so we know why energy matters now from a perspective of the person that needs it in the developed in the developing countries, but we also see what it does to the global temperature. What now would be the benefits if we all would have access not just to energy, but also to sustainable energy? One obvious one is, of course, to the people who get the access to energy. You know, you don't need to ask much further. Whether it's solar or wind or other things, particularly the smaller projects, do give the communities concerned a much stronger sense of empowerment, a much better ability to manage their own, much less dependence on large conglomerates that they might otherwise have to negotiate with, a better service very often because they're closer to the users. But there's another element of that. Anyone remembers that? Okay, Leonardo DiCaprio, right? On the Titanic, right? Anybody remembers what happened right after that picture? So the Titanic started sinking, right? And in the beginning, they were still running around, they were helping each other. Right? People were showing each other where the exit is. You know, he was trying to get her out, they were trying to help her. They were the musicians that were still making music. Right, people were trying to figure out where the boats are. Remember that? And then at some point, it all broke down. Right, at some point, people started pushing each other off the boats. And that's a really interesting aspect that where one can study what happens in international systems when helping each other or collaboration doesn't pay anymore. And that's a really interesting thing to think about. Some of the climatologists that we work with, they have analyzed the major shipwreck disasters, right? The ones where we have records from. And it is very clear, one can see where it all breaks down is when collaboration doesn't pay anymore. So that is when the degrees are starting to go so high. That is when we need to think about here in countries like ours that we really have a reason to work on the collaboration. We are currently in a time when it still makes sense. We have another 5 or 10 years, right? That's when then 15 years or so, when the changes don't happen then the collaborative opportunities we have won't work anymore. Paris was such a collaborative opportunity. Fabulous agreement, game-changing in fact. Many people would say that had the Sustainable Development Goals not been agreed beforehand, the agreement in Paris wouldn't have happened. And now the promises made need to be delivered on. And that is where I'm really looking forward to the next sessions, particularly coming after this first block that sets about a little bit of the framework, is what is actually happening in the ground on to make that happen. I just wanted to put up a couple of more things, and I have about 4 minutes, 5 minutes left. So this is a prediction of the International Energy Agency that basically expects a lower growth, but a growth on the fossil fuel side. They have one scenario under which the 2-degree growth would be expected, but that's a side scenario only, and that side scenario will require a lot of heavy lifting. So what this really means is that we are the first generation that has the chance to eliminate poverty and the last that has the chance to do something about climate change. Now, the transition that we all need is by 2030 in principle, right? 100% renewables, doubling, 100% access, sorry, doubling the renewable share and doubling the energy efficiency. Now, that we need though by much earlier than 2030, because if anybody wants to have access to education by 2030, they can't wait for energy to be there by 2030, right? They need it 10 years earlier. So we're in 2016 today. So we are really talking about something between 4 and 8 years. That is fast. Now, are we making progress and who is most affected? So there's a number of measurement issues that I don't want to go into, but what I can say is, yes, we are making some progress, but the sad thing is if you look at the bottom left, right, we're actually going worse. The access to clean cooking is going downwards. And nobody actually knows really at this point what's going to happen on the renewable energy access and generally on the access numbers with the population growth that we're facing. This is a really shocking number. If you hold the 1.1 billion by the 2.9 billion, what's the major difference between these two, on one on the right and one on the left? The one on the left is predominantly women. Interesting question to ask. Why are we making progress on the part that involves men as much as women, and practically no progress or negative progress on the part that relates to women? One of the things that we're now doing in sustainable energy for all is we're starting to put some actual numbers to that and showing it how it looks like. We are asking people to focus on where it matters most. 10 countries alone can make a major difference in access, and the access number covering 60% on the access. So what if we wouldn't work everywhere with the same effort, but focus some efforts really on where it matters most? Happening on the international level, there's a number of check-in processes in 2018 and going through the years thereafter. Again, I think here from our level makes less is less relevant for us, but important to know that people keep checking in. There are processes there. But where it really will be hitting the reality is where people make choices between the new life and the old life. And that is where Sustainable Energy for All, we as the UN initiative, were set up as a global partnership to go beyond the UN, to work with leaders, to help leaders take the decisions that they need. And we do that by bringing together evidence, by benchmarking progress, by seeing that we can bring people together, tell the voices of those that have, don't have the energy, and really make the connections that are needed. We do this by using strategic insight, building partnerships, and then using communications. But the strategic insight piece, I just wanted to show you, most people at this point have not shifted their energies towards the countries where it matters most. So if you look at these countries here, you will always find a country where you say, interesting. If these are the access countries or the energy efficiency countries, should we really work in them? But we've now connected that with where is actually the investment framework good? So if you want to invest somewhere, you shouldn't just invest everywhere. You should only invest where the investment framework actually gives you a chance. In the other ones, you should work on that investment framework. So we are overlaying information on access gaps or access deficit with information on how to work there. We're doing the same thing for clean cooking. Very interesting. You look at that number, clean cooking, right? That picture there. Now, when we look at the clean cooking places where progress has been made, all of a sudden there are countries such as Algeria that don't have a clean cooking gap now. They've handled that earlier. But we need to go and look for those that have made success in the addressing the gaps so that we can learn for them. Once we've done that, then we're pairing that with the investment needs. And that's when then the stories start rocking. Just for you here in Austria, energy efficiency. That's an agenda for all of us. It's the cheapest of all fuels. It's practically for free. But again, there are differences in investment framework. And so that overlaying that with each other is the space in which governments then can take decisions. We're doing that together with a whole number of groups, including, by the way, very purposefully, the private sector, who is leading a lot of changes now in country. We cannot leave this agenda to the UN agencies, to government agencies, or to civil society. We need to bring everybody together. Last one, how to implement the energy goals. Energy efficiency, of course, move, move, move. This is the cheapest one can do. Everyone can do it. A lot of people have already moved. Now it is about taking courageous decisions and going through the painful fact that maybe you need to switch off a production for a couple of days while you're installing the new equipment. The technology is there. It's all there. Nobody prevents us from doing it. And we need leaders who really build this concept of sustainable energy into their overall energy frameworks. Some countries are doing it. The biggest changes will be for the utilities, right? And for them, it means all of a sudden to integrate off-grid with the big grids. That's something that they've never done. Massive leadership challenges there. The financial guys, they are facing some major issues if they don't react, so this is already happening. Anybody seen The Economist of this week? Very interesting analysis already where the coal investments, for example, are starting to be a poor investment. This last year was the first year when there was more fresh investment in renewable energies than there was in traditional. There was more investment in the developing countries in that. Big change, if we want diversity and if we want a change in the energy industry, we need to have a mix of energy leaders too. Right now, the energy industry boardroom is practically only male. One thing that we do know is companies do better if there's women in the boardroom, something seriously to think about. There a number of critical success factors that take this agenda totally away from, you know, some women-oriented kind of thing into a place where if we want to have a massive transformation, we really need to have everybody on board. Policy as an accelerant, we'll hear more about that in a moment. Just one last plug, we'll have a big forum next spring where we're going to try to bring everyone together. Hopefully many of you will come also. We will assess progress there and then feature everybody there. The last thing I wanted to leave you with is, yes, we must no one leave left behind. We have the technologies. We know how to do it. We'll hear more about it later today. The one thing we don't have is time. Thank you.